Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Garth Greenwell read his story, An Evening Out, from the August 21st, 2017 issue of the magazine. Greenwell's first novel, What Belongs to You, was published last year. It won the British Book Award for Debut of the Year and was a finalist for several other prizes, including the Penn Faulkner. Now here's Garth Greenwell.
An Evening Out. Z had emptied half the carton of juice, and now I was holding it as he poured the vodka into the plastic funnel at the top. We had laughed at the way he threw his head back and drank, sucking the juice down even as he grimaced at the taste, which was sickly sweet. He refused to dump it in the gutter. My grandfather is Russian, he said. We never waste anything. And that, too, had made us laugh, though he was serious now as he poured, tilting the plastic flask so that the barest ribbon of liquid threaded perfectly into the carton. He didn't want to waste that either, and I was so absorbed in holding the carton still, and absorbed in Z, too, who stood close to me, our shoulders almost touching, that I had nearly forgotten about N when I heard the click of his phone as it took a picture of us. "What are you doing?" I said, and I'm sure there was a note in my voice of real concern at the thought of the image shared with others and anticipation of shame. But we had already drunk enough that the concern was distant, and N laughed it off. "I'm sorry," he said. "It's just too epic. We've been waiting for this for so long." He laughed again when I warned him not to post it on Facebook. "I'll hunt you down," I said, one of the phrases I had used often in my 7 years as a teacher, four of them here in Bulgaria, a career whose end we were celebrating that night. He held up his hand, smiling broadly. "Don't worry," he said. "I won't. I just want to remember this forever." Z took the carton from me and screwed back on the lid, shaking it vigorously and for far too long, making us laugh again. It was the second flask of vodka, the second carton of juice, the second time Z had taken in hand the mixing of our drinks. He would have poured for us if we'd had anything to use as cups. Instead, we drank straight from the carton, which he handed to me first and then to N before drinking from it himself. We were on a narrow street in the city center, standing beneath a street lamp in front of the little 24-hour shop where we had bought our supplies. It was already late, but we had half an hour or so before the concert at the club that was our real destination. Sofia is famous for these clubs, where the city's wealthy dance and drink. They're called chalgoteki, after the pop folk music they play. I had never been to one before. Everything in my temperament kept me away from them. But now, since I was leaving Sofia, Z had insisted that at least once I should have what he called a real Bulgarian night out. And the lure of him had overcome all my aversion to drunkenness and noise. I was eager for it, even. I planned to enjoy myself, to dance and drink, to relax in the company of these boys I genuinely liked, to be their friend for an evening, and not their teacher. The evening had started a few hours before, at a restaurant where I had promised to meet a group of students to say goodbye. They were already there when I arrived, 10 or 12 of them seated at tables they had pushed together. When they saw me, several of them stood up, their chairs scraping on the uneven patio, and they called out my name. Or not my name, really, but my family name. I mean, my father's name. Soon I wouldn't be that name anymore, I thought, feeling suddenly the relief of it. Of course, it was what they called me, though they weren't students anymore, or not my students. They had graduated a year earlier and were back in Sofia after their first year abroad in America or England or Amsterdam. They had scattered, as all my students here scatter. None of them had stayed behind. There was already wine at the table, three bottles open to breathe, a cheap Bulgarian white for the late June evening. Even as I took my seat, I could taste the twinge of it. But it was a pleasure to hold it up to the light, and more than a pleasure to hear them say my name again, my father's name. And then Z said, "To new beginnings," and we drank. It was terrible wine, but it didn't matter. I was as happy in that moment as I had ever been. There were more toasts over dinner as the waiters carried out dishes of the food my students had missed in their months away, salads and grilled meats and ceramic pots of vegetables and cheese. They toasted one another, their year away, their stories of London and New York. I had a fucking miserable year, In said when his term came. I mean, I knew it would be awful, but it was fucking miserable. I told you, Z said, I knew you weren't cut out to be a lawyer, and the girl next to him said, that's true, and everyone at the table expressed their agreement so that In raised his hands in surrender. Hey, he said, I wasn't the one who wanted it, but even Gospodina. And here he waved one of his hands toward me, calling me Mr., the word students use for a male teacher. Couldn't convince my mother it was a terrible idea. It was true that I had tried at the beginning of N's senior year when his mother came in for her quarterly conference. She never missed these meetings, even though it meant a two-hour drive from her home in Plovdiv, losing half a day of work. She was a serious woman, invariably dressed in a pantsuit, dark navy or gray, her black hair cut in a severe line just above her shoulders. She was gracious, too. And she had thanked me once for my influence, as she put it. You are the only teacher he works hard for, she said. This is the only class he likes. He isn't a stupid boy, she said, as she said at each of our meetings when we discussed his poor grades, his late or missing assignments, but oh, he is so lazy. But this time I demurred. It isn't exactly that he's lazy, I said. I saw her face tighten slightly with the wariness I often saw in parents when I began to speak about their children, a knitting of the brow that might have meant a special kind of attention, but was usually the opposite, was usually their attention closing off. When In is interested, he will work, I said, if it's something he likes. And here she turned her head to the side. She made a thick sound with her tongue in the back of her throat. Please. In's mother said, turning back to me, her tone at once dismissive and imploring, please, if he likes it. What will he do when he has a job? He can't only work when he wants to. I nodded and started to speak, but she went on, please, she said, I know what you will say. In has told me many times, you tell them they should do what they love. It's beautiful what you tell them. I see why they like you so much, she said, with a tight, conciliatory smile. I do tell them that, I said. I believe it. I took a breath. He has a talent, I said. I think he's lucky to have found it, and yes, I think he should follow what he loves and build his life around it. I paused. I had been wringing my hands beneath the table, knitting and unknitting my fingers, and now I laid them flat on top of it. I worry about N in law school, I said. I worry that he will keep doing badly. I think, and here I tried to make my voice lighter somehow, I think he should do what he feels called to do. I think he should study what he wants. She had been very still as I spoke, her tight smile unchanging. Yes, she said again. It's very beautiful what you say, very inspiring. And what does he do then, she said, after he studies what he wants? What does he do when he has to get a job? Things are different here, Gospodine. Maybe in America, what you say is true. You try something there, and if you fail, it is no problem. You try something else. Americans love starting over. You say it's never too late. But for us, it is always too late, she said. When N gets his diploma, he has to find a job, right away, a good job in England. If he doesn't, he has to come back here, and if he comes back here, it will be very hard for him to leave again. Do you understand? If he comes back here, he will be trapped. I know you care about him, she said, settling back in her chair. I know your heart, and she hesitated, groping for the phrase, your heart is in the right place. But what you say isn't true for us, please. You must help him see that. In groaned when I repeated this to him the next morning at school. You see, he said, she won't listen. It's impossible to talk to her. It's because she loves you, I said. It's a way of loving you. And he sighed and looked away. Well, In said at the restaurant table, lowering his hands before Z interrupted him. Listen up, Gospodine, he said, you're going to like this. In smiled at me. No more law school, he said. I'm transferring departments. In the fall, I'll be doing literature. There was a cheer around the table as several students said, Cestito, congratulations, and all of us lifted our wine. But what about your mother? I said after we drank. How did you convince her? In's smile widened. It was easy, he said. I just failed all my classes. And everyone laughed. I don't approve of your methods, I said, though I was laughing too, and Z raised his glass and said, to whatever works, and we toasted again. We toasted on the street, too, after a fashion, lifting the carton to one another before taking our drink. This had been our plan, to leave the others after dinner and drink together, just the three of us alone, a prelude to more drinking at the club. But the second or third time it made the circuit, I passed the carton directly to Z. Hey, he said, trying to give it back to me, you can't skip your turn. But I didn't take it. I need to slow down, I said. I can't drink as much as you. I was already feeling it, the wine from earlier and the vodka we were drinking too quickly now. I could feel the edges of myself softening, a kind of tingling like a limb waking up. It was dangerous to drink so much. I didn't have a sense of who I would be really drunk. I had never let myself go in that way as men around me did in my childhood. It was another way I had always been unlike them. Gospodine, Z said, his voice heavy with disappointment. Come on now. And he shook the carton, still holding it out to me. Don't let us down. All right, I said, relenting. And then, in a broad, cartoonish, Slavic accent, another classroom trick, I said, tonight I make exception, and drank deeply. Bravo, Z said, that's the way. And In said again, this is so epic, and then this is the best night of my life, which made all three of us laugh. Let's go, Z said then, and he set off quickly so that In and I struggled to keep up. Hey, copole, In said, bastard, slow down, why are you rushing? And Z turned and smiled, still walking, moving backward along the street. We don't want to be late, we'll miss the show, he said. He made a motion with his hips, a little Turkish shimmy before he turned back around. The club was a short walk away on Tsar Osvoboditel Boulevard, part of a complex that included one of the city's fanciest hotels. We showed our lichni karti to the two men stationed at the door, their torsos obscene with muscle, and then descended a long carpeted staircase that was lit dimly by red lights set high along the walls. The music got louder as we approached the glass door separating the corridor from the club proper, and it overwhelmed me as Z pulled them open and we stepped into a cavernous, dark room strafed by lights that spun somewhere above us. We made our way single file through the crowded space, toward the corner farthest from the entrance where there were a few unclaimed tables, small and chest high, each with an ashtray and an unopened bottle of gin. Near the bar, people stood with bottles and glasses, moving their shoulders and hips, dancing in place. There wasn't a dance floor, though what else could be the point of the place? With the music so loud, it was impossible to talk. After only a minute of it, my ears ached. A young woman came up to us holding a tray above her head as she angled her way through the crowd. She wore a white blouse several sizes too small, exposing her navel and button just barely above her breasts, which she allowed to touch Z, casually erotic, as she leaned over and pressed her face against his. She shouted something into his ear as she placed three glasses and a small bucket of ice on our table. He reciprocated her gesture, putting an arm around her shoulder, and In and I looked at each other and laughed. Z was always theatrical with women, a cartoon Lothario at 16 who had grown into real seduction. It was like he breathed sex as he exchanged comments with the server. They could almost have been kissing as they moved mouth to ear. But then Z drew back, letting his arm fall from her shoulder, and looked at her in disbelief. He jerked his head in a single vertical motion, a decided no. He started to turn toward N, but the waitress pressed her hand to his chest and gestured for him to come back. She spoke longer this time, her hand on his chest, balancing the empty tray on the table. Now Z did turn to N, shouting into his ear, and N shouted to me in turn that to stay at the table we had to buy the gin. Okay, I shouted back, how much? And when he told me 160 leva, 80 euro, I burst out laughing, making Z and N laugh too. But the woman didn't laugh. She shrugged, all her seductiveness gone. It's crazy, Z shouted. But the alternative was to stand in the packed space between the bar and the booths, where you could hardly breathe and where we wouldn't be a group at all. What would be the point of that? And so I pulled out my billfold. One night, I said, my throat already raw with shouting and with smoke, and they smiled and reached for their pockets. No, no, I said, wagging my forefinger. I didn't want them to spend their money. I had gone to the bancomat earlier that day. My wallet was full of bills, and I drew out several to hand to the woman, who smiled again, opening the gin and a can of tonic and pouring us our first drinks before she spun away. There were maybe 7 or 8 tables in our part of the room, almost all of them taken by groups of young people, 2 or 3 couples gathered at most of them, too many people for the small surface. In made a motion, then pointing back to the entrance and nodded to Z before he left. Z mouthed something at me, but I didn't understand. The music was too loud, and after he repeated it to no avail, he dropped his hands to his crotch and mimed a man pissing, his hand barely curled as if around an impossibly large cock. I laughed at this, both because it was funny and because it hid the other thing I felt. I mocked him, first holding my hand up, curled like his, making a doubtful face, and then I dropped both hands to my own crotch, as if holding a cock twice as large 3 times, and Z laughed too, a genuine laugh, I thought, though it wasn't very funny, and both of us seemed embarrassed a little once the laughter had passed. Then Z said something else, and again I didn't understand. So he took his phone out of his pocket and typed into it, holding up the screen for me to read. "This is a great night," he had written, and I looked up and said yes, and we raised our glasses to each other, clinking them before we drank. The music changed as we set our glasses down. There was a sudden assault of gaidi, the mountain bagpipes ubiquitous in folk music, and then a syncopated rush of drums that made both our faces break open in smiles. It was a song we knew, one of the big hits of Z's senior year, and we lifted our glasses again, toasting each other and the song and the memory of it we had. With the glass still at his lips, he began to dance. He extended his other arm away from his body and began to turn slightly from side to side, and though it was half ironic, it made me feel a kind of pang, since it was for me, his dance. I was his only audience, it could only be for me. It just lasted a minute. When he set his glass down, his other arm dropped too, his performance abandoned. But I picked it up. I raised my own arms, awkward and un-American. I shuffled a step toward him, and he was in it again. It was like I had given him permission to dance, to be foolish in front of me, since I was so much more foolish without his beauty or his youth. I was an old man in this place. But then he smiled at me, and I smiled back, and we were dancing with each other after a fashion. We made a little orbit together, a center of gravity. At one point, I reached over to him and put my hand on his shoulder, a friendly gesture, casual, avuncular maybe. And then I let my hand curve around his shoulder and down his arm. And as I felt him flex his biceps, that reflexive preening, I curled my fingers around the muscle there and squeezed, feeling how solid it was. I knew the gesture wasn't casual anymore, that it showed too much. I was touching him as I had never allowed myself to touch a student before. But he wasn't my student, I told myself. For one night, we could face each other without all that. I could touch his arm and have all of that fall away. Or maybe that's not what I thought. Maybe I'm adding it now. Maybe then all I felt was a seam or line drawn taut from my throat to my groin, a circuit that came alive in contact with him. He smiled and bent his arm at the elbow, pumping the muscle up, and I let my other hand join the first, linking my fingers around his arm to take in the full span of it. I had stopped dancing, I realized, and I dropped my hands as I felt the embarrassment of admiring him too long. But he didn't seem embarrassed. He didn't stop smiling, though he wasn't dancing anymore either. He stopped to slide his hand into the front pocket of his jeans, which were tight. My eyes followed as he worked his fingers in and slid out his phone. His face was studious in the light cast by the screen, and then he held it up to me and I saw that he had typed in all caps, Iron Man. He expected me to laugh, but I didn't laugh. I looked at him, past the glare of the phone, which must have been lighting my face now, letting him read whatever he could see there. I looked and shook my head from right to left in affirmation. Da, I said, though he couldn't hear me or the tone in which I said it, which was a serious tone, grave, da. He slid the phone back in his pocket, smiling more broadly, and took a half step toward me, coming around the table. He squared himself off, facing me and planting both his feet like a challenge, and then he balled one of his hands into a fist and struck his own stomach twice, hard, showing off the muscles there too, before he opened his hand to make a welcoming gesture, jerking his head up in invitation. He wanted me to try, and when I didn't immediately strike him, he reached out and grabbed my wrist, pulling it toward his stomach. I made a fist and let him strike himself with it. I felt the strength of him there. He was like iron, I thought, or like something dearer, really, like marble. And when he gestured for me to hit him again harder, I did hit him, not very hard, but hard enough to satisfy him. I left my hand there, my knuckles flush with his abdomen, and then I opened my hand and laid my palm flat against his stomach, the cotton of his shirt just slightly damp with sweat, and let my fingers trace the muscles there, risen in their rows as he clenched them. I curved the ends of my fingers around them and pressed against them as long as I dared. Then I released my grip and smiled, and brushed his stomach quickly up and down with the back of my hand as if to erase the trace of how I had touched him. I took my glass from the table and with a grimace drank what was left. The same song was still playing. Only a couple of minutes had passed, though it seemed much longer that I had let myself admire him. As soon as I set my glass down, Z was filling it, gallant again, and then N was back from the bathroom, lifting his own glass expectantly so that Z filled it too, and then his own, and once more we were toasting one another. I glanced around quickly, aware that everything I had felt would have been obvious to anyone watching us, but no one was watching us. In the dim light, I could see the other tables and beyond them the crowded floor unchanged. I put my arm around N's shoulders, friendly, trying to regularize touch, and he and I danced together. Another song had come on, one I didn't know, but that didn't matter. You can always dance to Chalga, that's the whole point of it, its single virtue. I had turned away from Z to dance with N, who wasn't a good dancer at all. He didn't even try to dance well. He made all his movements ironic, self-deprecating, an extension of the persona he had taken on in class, which was endearing, but also a product of uncertainty or doubt, a kind of abnegation. I wanted him to grow out of it, but now I played along, laughing, dancing in the same way, our motions silly and shuffling, a game that was in a way the opposite of Eros, and so a relief to me. I had only lost track of him for a minute or two, but when I looked over again, Z had disappeared. He must have gone to the bathroom, I thought, and immediately I stopped dancing. I shouted to N that I was going to piss, at which he nodded, and I left him without a thought for how odd it was to leave him there alone, how transparent it must have been. I would think of it only later. I moved through the crowd as quickly as I could, and then in the dimness ahead there was a sudden rectangle of porcelain light as a door opened and I was in a large, bright room, tiled and clean. There was a line of three urinals, from one end of which a man was stepping away, zipping himself up. Z was at the other, I saw with relief. I wasn't too late, and I stepped up beside him, breaking that distributive propriety of men's bathrooms, a guard against unchecked glances, against desire. He looked over quickly and saw it was me and smiled a little blurrily. I thought he was drunker than I was or drunker than I felt, and then he faced forward again. I didn't face forward, though I could have. I could still have seen what I wanted to see. I let my eyes track down the front of him, following the line of buttons down his shirt, which was ridiculous in the fluorescent light, a kind of garish violet. Even in my excitement, I admired the neatness of it, the buttons perfectly aligned, so that I thought, for the first time in many years, of my father dressing me as a boy, teaching me about this line, the gig line, he called it, buttons and buckle forming an order that was more than vanity, that signaled some deeper righteousness. The memory came in a flash before I let myself look at his cock, pale in his hand and pissing a pale line against the porcelain, nothing extraordinary, not small or particularly large, a handsome cock. And I felt my own stiffen slightly when I saw that with his index finger he was rubbing just slightly the underside of the head, where he held the foreskin back, an unconscious gesture probably, though it must have sent a small current of pleasure alongside the pleasure of pissing. I knew I was acting badly, that I was looking too brazenly and too long, that I shouldn't have looked at all. I would be ashamed later, but I wasn't ashamed now. I kept watching as the stream weakened and became intermittent. Let him know, I said to myself. He already knows. Let him see it. He let go of the head to pull the foreskin all the way back and shake himself before he pinched the base and drew his fingers up the shaft, stretching himself out to his full length and flicking off the drop of urine that hung at the tip. He did this two or three times and then stopped, leaving his cock dangling for a long moment in which I felt my excitement mount and become unbearable. There wasn't any point to it, I thought. He must be letting me see. It might be a kind of invitation, before he tucked himself away and drew up his fly. Only then did I look at his face. Our eyes met. He had been watching me, or maybe he had only looked over at that moment. I don't know. He held my gaze without speaking, and I knew that if he gave any sign, I would do whatever he wanted, or rather, whatever he would let me do. I would go into one of the stalls with him or leave the club, walk out without a word to in. I didn't care. Whatever he wanted, I would do. He closed his eyes for a moment, a too long blink, and swayed slightly before opening them again and righting himself. Then he leaned my way, crossing into my space, and said, I'm really drunk, shouting it to me. The music was loud in the bathroom, too. The door did nothing to keep it out. He leaned away again. Let's listen to the concert and then go home, he said, and turned, walking to the sink to run water over his hands before going back into the club. I didn't follow right away. I stayed at the urinal, waiting for my excitement to settle until the door opened and another man walked in, a fat man in an expensive suit, who stationed himself at the urinal beside me and with a sigh began to piss. N and Z were standing at the table, not dancing anymore, with full glasses in front of them, and as I joined them, Z refilled my glass too. He was smiling. There wasn't any sign of what had happened as we knocked glasses, holding each other's eyes to say Nazdrave. I looked for some special message from him, but there was none. While we were drinking, the music abruptly tapered and cut off, leaving a kind of roaring in its wake, and then over the speakers a man's voice, loud and deep, theatrical, said, Dami gospoda, ladies and gentlemen, and in a burst of quick syllables I couldn't quite follow, announced Andrea, the singer we had come to see. With a single strike on a deep drum, the lights snapped out and then came back up, even dimmer, and with another strike, a stage I hadn't noticed was bathed in white light. It was against the opposite wall on the other side of the bar, though we could see just fine. It wasn't as large a space as I had thought. A roar went up when the music started, the intro of Andrea's most popular song, Haide Opa, the words all but meaningless, nearly nonsense, and another when a door in the wall opened and she stepped out onto the stage, followed by four other women. They wore skimpy two-piece outfits that exposed their midriffs, the four dancers almost identical, Andrea set off by what looked like a fur vest, plush and white, hanging open around her breasts, and by her hair, which wasn't gathered back like the others but teased into a blonde mane. It was a small stage. They could hardly move. They mostly lifted their arms and spun, sometimes bending their knees deeply, everything exaggeratedly sexual. We had moved from our spots around the table and were standing in a line in front of it, Z in the middle dancing so that we knocked into each other, our shoulders and hips, and then Z put his arms around our shoulders and drew us tight, hugging us. When I looked over, he was smiling, watching Andrea, smiling more when he turned his head and looked at me, and I smiled back, happy, pressing against him, reaching around him to squeeze in shoulder, and he smiled at me too. I tried to give Z room to dance, but he held me tight, making me move alongside him, his flank hot against mine, his arm hot against my back, so that I felt myself swept by a wave of happiness or joy, my face stretched stupidly in a grin. I must look foolish, I thought somewhere, but there was so much pleasure in being a fool. Why had I spent so much of my life guarding against it? I looked at Z and N and saw my feeling mirrored back at me, their faces shone in the dark, or that's how I remember it, as though they were caught in the flare of a camera's flash. But no one was taking pictures. It's only my imagination that casts such light on them. On the stage, Andrea was pacing back and forth like a cat in a cage. And then Z stumbled beside me. He lost his footing and fell, or almost fell, gripping my shoulder so that I was pulled forward with him and I reached around with my other arm to catch him around the waist. "Whoa," I said, struggling to hold him up as just for a second he was a dead weight in my arms. Then his legs found purchase, and as he unfolded himself to stand straight again, I saw that my hand had fallen to his crotch. I don't think I willed it, not exactly. I think it was almost an accident, but I didn't remove it either. I looked at it as if it were something disconnected from me with its own impulses and acts, its own culpability. And though it wasn't groping him or moving at all, it was culpable. It was a violation. I knew this even as I looked at it in a kind of shock. I glanced at Z's face and saw he was looking too, not with any response I could read, and then he looked up. Not at me or at the stage, but simply forward, his face clouded with an expression not of anger or dismay, but of bewilderment, I thought. And coming to myself suddenly, I snatched away my hand. I looked quickly at In, who seemed not to have noticed anything. He was still dancing, watching the show, absorbed in the music or in Andrea. Z stood motionless beside me, his arm around my shoulder, his face not clouded anymore, but blank. I looked away from him back to the stage, feeling a heat in my gut that I recognized as shame, but it wasn't sharp yet. It was distant or dulled, and though I knew in the next days I would be miserable with it, I turned away from it now. "Tomorrow you will feel it," I said to myself. "Feel it then. Don't feel it now." I started dancing again, and when I moved, Z began to move too. He let his arm fall from my shoulder, but began shifting again side to side with the music, and soon he was smiling as he had been before. Maybe he thinks it was an accident, I thought. Maybe it was an accident. Maybe there's no need for shame, even as I knew that wasn't the case. Or maybe he was so drunk he would forget it. And then the only shame would be a private shame, the shame I was accustomed to, the shame that felt like home. Z stumbled again, this time falling away from me toward In, who caught him and kept him on his feet. In looked at me and laughed as Z stood up again, closing his eyes in a long blink and swaying so that both of us put our hands on his shoulders to keep him upright. I looked at In and tilted my head toward the entrance. "We should go," I shouted, and he weaved his head from left to right. We each took one of Z's arms. We had to walk sideways in single file to get through the crowd, though people tried to make room for us, smiling and moving out of our way as best they could. We must have been a familiar sight, two friends helping a third, and again I had the feeling of belonging with them, which was warm and present and drowned out my premonition of shame. We climbed the stairs and pushed out into the night air, nodding at the two men who didn't acknowledge us, and I sucked in great breaths as if I had been starving for it. Z wavered again, leaning hard against me, and we sat on the curb to wait for the cab In had called. Z bent forward, his elbows propped on his knees, and moaned, and In and I laughed at him. "Nogo si slabe," I said. "You're very weak. I expected better." And I gripped his shoulder so that he leaned into me. But then it was as if he slipped or lost his balance. He fell across my lap, and a single fluent stream of vomit struck the pavement beside my shoes. He stayed in that position, draped across my lap, and I bent over him, as if to shield him from something, and rubbed his back, the fabric of his shirt damp with sweat. Ne sais chus fum dubre, he said, pushing himself upright. I don't feel well. And N told him not to worry. They were going home. He would sleep it off. They would go to Z's apartment, which was somewhere nearby, the studio his family kept and that Z had claimed as his own, a place to take girls and have small gatherings. It was only big enough for 5 or 6 people, he had told me. He was still slumped against me. I could feel the heat of him against my side. When the cab came, we stood, N and I pulling Z up and leading him to the car. N got in first, and then he helped Z. Will you be okay? I asked as Z pulled his legs in, half lying across N's lap. But you're coming, N said. Don't you want to come with us? We can hang out at Z's place. And Z echoed him, saying, yes, come, gospodine, his voice slurred with drink. I stood with my hand on the car, hesitating, wanting to join them, and imagining what might still happen, the possibilities of privacy with Z. I was tempted to try them. But I stepped back instead. No, I said, I have to go home. It's too late already. But thank you for tonight, I said. I had so much fun. Thank you. It was a great night, Z said, letting his head fall as I swung the door shut. I didn't have to wait long for another taxi to appear. One pulled up almost right away, letting a couple out in front of the club. On the ride to Mladost, I felt myself sinking into drunkenness, or felt drunkenness rise around me, so that even as I responded to the driver's small talk, I closed my eyes and could feel my head roll to the side before I yanked it up again. I waved to the guards in their booth at the American College as the cab pulled away, and then I was beyond the glare of the flood lamps on the dark road that led to the school. For 3 years, I had walked this path every day, morning and afternoon, with the weight of the day before me or with the relief of casting it off. And even now that I lived on campus, I walked it often, to the store or the gym, to cabs waiting at the gates. I walked it slowly now, feeling how easily I could stumble, taking a step or two to one side before I brought myself back to line. So this is what that is, I thought, remembering the drunks I had seen weaving in this way, imagining what I must look like to the guards in their booth, how maybe they had turned to watch me. People often watch drunks stumbling around. It amuses them, I don't know why. In me, it has often aroused a darker feeling, pity or sometimes disdain. It wasn't funny at all, I would think. There was nothing innocent in it. It was a kind of willful abnegation of judgment, of responsibility. What have I done? I thought suddenly. What have I done? I turned onto the path between buildings, on the right the asphalt of the basketball court where boys played soccer in the mornings and afternoons, and on the left the line of academic buildings, in the most stately of which I had taught all my students, classes coming and going, Z and N coming twice, still boys in 10th grade, and 2 years later something closer to men. It's a kind of performance, of course. All teaching is pretending. I had stood before them as a kind of poem of myself, an ideal image, when for a few hours every day I had been able to hide or mostly hide the disorder of my life, hide most of all the hunger that disorders most, and if I hadn't succeeded entirely with Z, I had almost succeeded. If he had seen glimpses of what I was, he had never until tonight seen me fully. I had leered at him. I had touched him. I had been a caricature of myself, I thought, but that isn't true. I had been myself without impediment. Maybe that's the way to say it. I followed the path through the wooded part of campus, the trees that separate the main buildings from the faculty houses. The 2 floors of my cottage had been divided into apartments, of which mine was the loveliest, I thought, on the ground floor with windows facing into the trees. I had moved in less than a year before, tired of taking the bus each morning from my apartment off campus. I hadn't known how soon I would be leaving, not just Sophia, but teaching altogether. It had become unbearable, the drudgery and routine of it. Earlier that spring, I had realized I couldn't face another year. A short set of stairs led to my door, 4 or 5 steps, and as I began to climb them, I stumbled, catching myself with my hands and then falling onto my side against the concrete where I lay or half lay for a moment before sitting upright on the bottom step. I swallowed hard against a wave of nausea. Of nausea and something else. They were indistinguishable. 7 years, I thought. 7 years undone, a betrayal of vocation. But I rejected this even as I thought it. It wasn't my vocation. It was just something I had done. A way I had passed the time. Don't be so pious, something said in me, and something else cringed away. I swallowed again. I couldn't be sick here. Everyone would see it. If I was going to be sick, I had to get inside. But though I willed myself to stand, I remained where I was, barely upright, my hands buttressed at my side and my torso bent forward, swaying a little. I was exaggerating or making excuses. It wasn't so bad, or it was worse. You can't know tonight, I thought. In the morning you'll know. And I feared what I would feel. How my actions would look in the light of day. Those were the words I used, the light of day. I was thinking in old phrases. I tried to stand again, lifting myself a few inches before I dropped back down. I heard a sound then and looked up, and saw coming along the path toward me the fat shape of Mama Dog, her tail beating in the dark. She was the only dog allowed on campus. For years she had kept other dogs away, but now she was too old to guard anything, and she spent most of the day sleeping, on the porches of our houses or beside the guards where they sat in the shade. She was always happy to see me. I gave her treats sometimes, but I didn't have anything for her now, and I told her this, Nyamam Nishto, opening my empty hands. She cocked her head, that look of understanding dogs give or of wanting to understand their demand for attention. Obichamte, I said to her, I love you, but tonight I don't have anything. Go away, I said, Mahese, and I made a shooing motion with my hand. But she didn't go. She stood staring at me, the movement of her tail slowing just slightly, and then she inched forward and pressed her snout against my hand, her nose wet in my palm. Still I didn't respond, but she insisted, jerking her nose up as if to toss my hand to her head where she wanted to be scratched. This made me relent. I laughed and said, okay, Mama, okay, as I raked my fingers through her fur. She whined happily and came closer, pressing her trunk against my leg and rippling her body in that puppyish movement that communicates joy better than anything we can manage. So that I brought my other hand to her as well and scratched along both her sides, feeling bits of leaf and pine needles and accumulated grime. You're filthy, I said, but I love you. And I bent my face down to hers, touching our foreheads together and gripping her in something like a hug. She tolerated this for a moment, and then she tilted her snout slightly up and quickly licked my face, her tongue wet across my lips. I pulled back, making a sound of disgust and wiping my lips clean. But then I laughed again. She pressed against me more insistently, rubbing the top of her head against my jeans. She wanted a treat and wanted more to be let inside. She had been a house dog once, I had heard. Years ago, she had belonged to a foreign teacher who left her behind when he went back to the States. She loved to sleep in our houses. But we had been told it wasn't allowed. She was almost always dirty, and though she was treated for fleas and ticks, you could never be sure. She was an outdoor dog now. We shouldn't encourage her. But there was no one around to admonish me. And so, Ella, I said to her, come on. And then I stood, successfully this time, maybe because Mama kept her side pressed against me as if to prop me up as I kept one hand against the brick wall of the house. She whined at the door as I fumbled the key into the lock. Okay, Mama, I said soothingly again. Okay. I would take the box of treats from the cabinet above the sink. I would put towels down on the kitchen floor so she would have a soft place to lie down. She was dirty, But what was a little dirt, I thought as I turned the latch. I should have let you in a long time ago, I said. I'm sorry. I pushed the door open, and she went ahead of me into the house, going just a few feet before she dropped onto the tile of the entranceway, a spot she claimed as if it had long been hers, and gave a quick, deep sigh as she laid her head on her paws. She kept her eyes on me as I tossed my keys in the little dish by the door, her tail more subdued but still striking the wall beside her as I put my bag down, waiting for the dizziness to pass. "Okay, Mama," I said again. "You sleep there. We'll sleep, and in the morning we'll feel better." Though I feared I wouldn't feel better. In body and spirit both, I thought I would likely feel much worse. And then, because the dizziness didn't pass, or maybe because I wanted her warmth next to me, I lowered myself to the floor. I stretched myself out beside her and laid one hand on her flank. "We'll sleep," I said again. And she rolled onto her side, her stomach toward me, and placed one of her paws against my chest. It would leave a mark, I knew. I would have to scrub it out in the morning. But what did it matter, I thought as I closed my eyes. What does it matter? Why not let it stay?
That was Garth Greenwell reading his story, An Evening Out. He has written nonfiction for The New Yorker. This is his first piece of fiction in the magazine. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Akhil Sharma reads Baster by Jeffrey Eugenides. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.